My Taste with Bibendum Wine, supplier to the UK's top restaurants and bars.
Hello from Nigel Williams and welcome to our programme which seeks to augment your food and drink experiences with the help of our studio guests. This week, restaurant owners and brothers Sam and Eddie Hart. They famously took Spanish food to another level in this country with their restaurant Fino, followed by the genuine tapas bar Barafina. Food is very much in their DNA, as you're about to hear. Sam, Eddie, welcome. Now, your father had a Michelin star restaurant, but Sam, you didn't go and work for him.
No, I mean, I had spent a few summers working in the kitchens there growing up, but having seen restaurants from the inside, I always vowed that I'd have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, gradually over as time passed, I got sucked into it.
Uh-huh. Meanwhile, Eddie, you went straight for it. So a bit of a difference there. You would have seen the same horror sights in the kitchen that your brother did, but you didn't mind so much.
Well, I couldn't really think of what else to do or who else would employ me. And I thought that my dad, certainly to start with, was likely to kind of, give me a job, reluctantly perhaps. and so it was straight into the kind of, kitchen pot wash. And rolled up my sleeves, but I loved it. I loved the kind of the human element of the restaurant business, I'm afraid I've always had the bug.
And this is quite an upmarket. They had a Michelin star, didn't they, your dad?
Dad opened a small, kind of luxury country house hotel, mm-hmm. In a county called Rutland, about 2.5 hours north of London, and it's lovely. It's right on Rutland Water. So it was a great place to kind of, to work and cut my teeth.
Yeah. And so after pot wash, what happened to you then after that?
Escalated. I was promoted to the dizzy heights, I think, probably of a waiter after that.
But you're forgetting chambermaid.
Oh, chambermaid. Yes, chambermaid. although I didn't have to wear a pinny, which is a bit of a relief. But what's nice about a hotel as a training ground, if you want to be in the industry, is that if you're lucky enough, you can be moved around the different departments, so you get to have a look at all the different kind of aspects.
Mm-hmm. So the good grounding for you there. Meanwhile, Sam, you had a could I call it a dalliance with the city, and then off to Mexico. What's the story there?
Yeah. So I was working as a money broker in London. And got the opportunity to go to Mexico City to help open their office there. Mm-hmm. And I love Mexico City, hated money broking, and ended up opening a nightclub in Mexico City, which I stayed for 5 years doing that.
This isn't the safest city in the world, so was it risky business?
Yes, I mean, Mexico, exactly, is quite a dangerous city. We used to have to occasionally confiscate guns at the door if we had famous people with their bodyguards. We didn't really like bodyguards coming in because they're professional fighters rather than drunk amateur fighters. So it can cause real damage. But if they had to, if it was someone like the president's son or something, we'd confiscate their guns and we'd occasionally have a sort of great stack of firearms in our office.
Wow.
But no, we survived it, so it was and good fun, exciting.
Interesting grounding. So I guess putting the two of you back together then, so your brother's back at home, learning the nitty-gritty of the restaurant business, you're doing the running the business stuff. When did it come together that you were going to start working together?
Well, I had a sort of 6 months living in Barcelona on the way back from Mexico to acclimatise to European life once again, and fell in love with Spanish food and, in particular, a restaurant there called Cal Pep. And got a phone call from Eddie saying, you're not really doing anything in Barcelona. Why don't we get together and do something back in England? And actually, to start with, we thought we might open a pub in the countryside. And spent probably 3 or 4 months, I reckon, on that project. And until my now wife, then girlfriend, said, "Look, you're only 26 or 27. We'll all go stir crazy, sitting in this pub in the countryside. And why don't we, go and do something in London?" So with our sort of experience of Spanish food and love of Spanish food, we did Fino.
And this experience, Eddie, came from your mum in Mallorca, is that right?
Mum grew up in a small village on the northwest coast in Mallorca. And summer holidays have always been there, you know, in the house where she grew up. So we've, you know, I suppose we've always had a real kind of passion for all things Hispanic. And in fact, Mum, you know, always used to kind of cook, you know, very, you know, Spanish influenced kind of food. And I remember kind of garlic, you know, when we were growing up in Rutland, in the kind of late 70s, early 80s, you know, was still a pretty exotic, you know, ingredient, as were red peppers or aubergines. And I think, you know, quite a lot of our mates who come over for tea or, you know, and, you know, just thought that this food was pretty wild and exotic. And in fact, there were, I think there were friends of mum and dad's growing up then, you know, that would, you know, turn their nose up at this exotic muck.
Yes.
You know, but it says that that was really our grounding and you know, how both Sam and I think, you know, came to, you know, be involved with Spanish restaurants.
Okay. And is that where you picked up this, you know, what has become the way, if you want to run a fine dining restaurant, this idea of looking for the great ingredients? That probably came from Mum looking around for the best stuff. Would that be right?
Well, I suppose that, our, you know, our father's had a Michelin-starred restaurant for 33 years now or something. So we grew up eating extremely well. And he's very keen on great ingredients, as is our mother separately. But my real, I think my seminal moment of really great ingredients was when I was living in Barcelona and spending time in the Boqueria, which is one of the great markets of the world. And they had amazing ingredients. So they weren't just sort of good, they were really, really world class. And the Spaniards have a thing, you know, traditionally of it being very ingredient led. And simple as well. So it was a sort of real inspiration, I suppose.
So you decided that you wanted to do something Spanish in the creation of Fino, but what next?
Sam and I took a very, very, very small office. And by small, I mean that we were kind of literally sitting on each other's laps and you could only be one person on the telephone. You couldn't, obviously you couldn't hear yourself kind of think. And we spent about a year or longer with a list of 40 agents, and we split the list down, you know, down the middle. And every day we'd ring these agents and we'd say, "Please, we know we're looking for a restaurant site in London." And Sam and I, you know, young, no covenant, you know, weren't a particularly attractive kind of, you know, proposition to central London landlords. And so we really struggled. And our dad very sweetly said, "Do you want to come under my umbrella?"
Yes.
You know, and so I can kind of be a name and kind of a covenant behind you. And we said, "You know, for God's sake, Dad, you know, the last thing we want to do is drag you into some terrible mess." I said, "You know, if we're going to mess this up, we're going to mess it up on our own." And eventually we were shown Fino, which is just off Charlotte Street. And we never wanted to be in a basement, you know, but basements are famously difficult to, you know, lure your clientele down into.
Yes.
I suppose depending on what you do, what kind of operation it is. But, you know, as a restaurant. And so but it was quite a glamorous space. It had high ceilings and we thought, you know, we hadn't seen anything any better. So we thought, this is it.
Yeah.
So actually, you know, we were excited by the space. So that was the start of the journey.
And you speculated, what, £1 million on that, Sam?
Yeah, it was £1 million. But it was back in the days where the bank would lend you quite a lot of that.
Yeah.
So I don't think, I mean, we didn't have anything like £1 million. I think Eddie and I had scraped together something like 80,000 quid each or something like that.
But yes.
And we had another couple of investors. But it was obviously pre-recession and all that sort of thing. And you could, even as a startup, which you'd never get. I mean, these days, we would still never get that sort of ratio loan from the bank. No way.
Yeah.
But back in those days, you could. It was all a bit easier. So we managed to borrow quite a lot somehow or another.
And then because you were sort of young and naive, you then accidentally was a runaway success and you didn't worry about it.
Well, Dad always said, you know, that kind of, you know, there's a great advantage in being young and naive in business because you don't, you know, foresee, you know, all the kind of the potential potholes and disasters waiting around the corner. And I think I think it was very nice having Dad there also on the end of the phone, you know, who was experienced and a professional and had been successful in the industry. You know, and although we tried to do it on our own, it was very nice having that backup and that expertise.
I suppose we were incredibly lucky because we had a brilliant head chef right from the start, and which was complete luck, really. I mean, because we'd interviewed a few different people and they'd done tastings for us, and you know, really, it was they'd all been incredibly disappointing. And then we went to this tasting with our first head chef, Jean-Philippe Petruno, and he produced a staggering array of something like 30 dishes. he was cooking at Simply Nico at the time.
I remember there was four different types of quail.
I think three lobsters. And anyway, so we were completely bowled away by the quality of the food.
Yes.
And it meant that, you know, luckily on day one when we opened, where there's plenty of things that weren't right, you know, the service was in a mess and everything's chaos and confused, at least the food was really good right from the beginning. And that got us off on the right start.
On the way to the tasting with Jean-Philippe, who became our first head chef, Sam said to me on the way, he said, I'm really hungry. And I said, well, that's probably quite a good thing. We're just heading off this, you know, gigantic tasting. So I said, no, it's a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. I said, well, what do you... He said, well, you know, if you're hungry, everything's going to taste delicious. So we stopped at a corner shop and bought a baguette and ate this baguette before we... Which I thought was really dedicated, you know, kind of...
That's a great story. There are thousands of restaurants just in London. What was it that at Fino you were trying to provide? What was the gap in the market?
I think we felt that there was plenty of room in London for, you know, really top quality Spanish food. You know, I think that, you know, there were lots of tapas restaurants, you know, in the kind of more of the kind of, you know, residential areas of London, but very few really in central London. And I think, you know, and very few Spanish restaurants that were really serving the very best of Spain. And I think the reason for that is that a plate of jamón is very expensive. You know, there's no way around that. You know, it's going to be £18 or £20 in a restaurant for whatever it is, a 50 gram portion. And I think, you know, the tapas restaurants that or the majority of them that were around at that time, you know, they're out in the residential areas. They didn't feel that they could charge that. So, you know, so we really wanted to bring, you know, fantastic ingredients, the best of Spain, to the table, and serve it in a kind of, you know, West End and hopefully kind of glamorous and, you know, fun environment.
And did people get that straight away? You know, it's a plate of ham and you're charging me 20-odd quid.
Well, amazingly, they sort of did. They definitely did. We were lucky. We opened on our first day. Was it our first customer, Jan Moyer? I think Jan Moyer was writing in the Telegraph at the time. I'm pretty certain she was the first customer through the door. And 3 days later, there was a huge review on the back of the Telegraph. She absolutely loved it. And it went from there. And then, you know, the rest of the critics, the huge majority of them came and enjoyed it as well. And so did the public. So I think, you know, it was the era of cheap flights had opened up real Spain. So people weren't just doing...
The Costas.
The Costas and the, you know, fish and chips on the Costas. They were going to cities that they hadn't been before. And so there really was amongst the people in London, which is why we thought London was ready for it, you know, good knowledge and desire and to eat proper Spanish food rather than, you know, microwaved Spanish food.
How about the wines? Because that's another area where people probably, if you're into your wines, quite easy to... you know, learn the French regions and know what you're getting. You look through a wine list, but taking that step into Spain, not quite so easy. So did you have that challenge with serving Spanish wines?
I think people definitely, you know, knew what a you know, red Rioja was. They might have heard of an Albarino just, I suppose, 11 years ago. And we certainly could have wanted to really champion some of our favourite wines from Spain, you know, stylistically. So we really got behind Sherry, which was, you know, which is both Sam and I are passionate about. And it was really rewarding to see, you know, I'm not saying that we were solely responsible for it at all, but, you know, it was so rewarding at the restaurant to see that over a period of time, our regulars and clients really did know what they were talking about, and then they would order a cold manzanilla and, you know, really, you know, enjoy it. So that was one side. And I suppose we, over a period of time, actually we started with an international list because we didn't have the confidence to say, well, it's all Spanish and, you know,
We'll show you something you might like.
Exactly. So there was New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, you know, white Burgundy. But I can't remember how long the international list lasted for? Do you think it was 6 months or something?
About 6 months.
It wasn't that long.
Until we were bullied into kind of going completely Spanish, which was totally the right thing to do.
That's right. Well, we're going to get you to choose some wine a little bit later on. Let's get on to where we've talked loads about Fino, because this was the start. And then you went on to a sort of more informal version a few years later, didn't you, with your Barrettinas?
So, yeah, I mean, funnily enough, that Fino was inspired, as I mentioned before, by this restaurant, Cal Pep, in Barcelona. But Cal Pep is very, very similar to Barrafina, which was our second restaurant. So in the fact that it doesn't have any bookings, is bar only, very small, 23 seats. And funny enough, actually, Barrafina shares the same amount of seats as Cal Pep does. But when we opened Fino, we didn't quite have the confidence. We didn't feel London was ready for, mm-hmm. you know, the real deal, as it were.
Yes.
You know, so we still have an eating bar at Fino, which is great. But it's also got tables, so, you know, it blended the two. But after about, I suppose, 3 years of Fino, we thought that the Spanish food scene in London had moved on enough to do a much more purist tapas bar, and opened Barrafina, I think, in 2006 or 7, something like that.
I've got 2007.
January 2007.
It says that on Wikipedia, so it's got to be true.
That's brilliant. January 2007, exactly. But it's really fun because all the cooking's straight in front of you. You sit at the bar, it's very small, and you have this incredible atmosphere and energy, you know, with all the food and all the action going on straight in front of you.
So then things got really serious with, not to say it wasn't serious before, but purchasing Quo Vadis, which got such a famous history and even got a blue plaque from when Karl Marx lived there. Apparently that was only for, I've got 5 years here, 1851 to 1856. But anyway, it's a famous restaurant, you know, destination restaurant. And you moved in to buy that. Why would that be, Eddie?
Very good question. Sam and I actually were walking the streets of Soho with an agent, looking for a potential second site for Barrafina. And I think the route between Fino on foot and Barrafina and Fifth Street took us on a daily basis past the front of Quo Vadis. And that time, I think, you know, Marco Pier White had, you know, was kind of towards the end of his time there. And the building slightly looked like it needed some TLC. And the agent said to us, isn't it a fabulous building? And someone said, we love it. You know, it's such a, you know, with the stained glass and, it just looked like such a fantastic building. And he said, would you guys ever be interested? We said, absolutely not. No, this is kind of, you know, so far removed from, you know, and it's too big and it's, you know, absolutely not. And he said, you sure? And we say, obviously, he planted the seed. Sam and I then started talking about it and kind of somehow couldn't get it out of our minds. And, you know, and the idea that, you know, it slightly needed kind of, you know, the next person to kind of take the reins. But, you know, and that's the great thing about Quo Vadis, is that it doesn't really feel like our restaurant. You're just the custodian for the next period. It opened in 1926. But it's nice to be part of its history. And six months later, we had the keys in our hands, wondering quite what to do with it.
I was probably considering more than a million, though I'm too polite to ask. But you took the step then of basically closing it all down and starting all over again. Why was that, Sam?
Well, it had been run into the ground, I suppose, really, by the previous incumbents, and needed quite a lot of, first of all, investment, but also it just needed to stop, to change, and to, you know, reopen again. I think, you know, we spent 6 months, you know, remodeling it to the degree that we could. You know, if you did a proper remodel on that building, you could be there for years.
Yes.
You know, because it's been sort of patched and you know, refitted bit by bit over what's now something like 85. I think it's coming up for its 90th anniversary quite soon. So over a long period of time.
Well, it's a fine stable of restaurants. Great to hear about that. Let's find out about when you're not eating in your own restaurants. Eddie, let's take your first. So close to home, you live in a boat.
Don't I do.
You? So that's near Chelsea. So where'd you go?
Underneath kind of Battersea Rail Bridge.
Yes. So where would you go to a neighbourhood restaurant there? What's your favourite?
Oh, I see a neighbourhood restaurant there. mostly my favourite restaurants in London tend to be kind of in the West End. Mm-hmm. And the one that kind of just sprung to mind as a neighbourhood restaurant, which I think is fantastic. It's on Frith Street, and it's just a couple of doors down from us at Barrafina, and it's called Koya. And it's an udon noodle restaurant. And it, you know, I haven't been to Japan, although I long to go. It appears to be very authentic and not kind of lightened for the English palate. And it's inexpensive, delicious. And that was what immediately sprung to mind.
Sam, I gather you probably don't live on a boat. Otherwise, that would be a bit weird, wouldn't it, really?
Exactly. So, no, I live in Acton.
Acton, much more down-to-earth there.
Exactly.
Proper central line there.
Yeah, Acton, down-to-earth, not surrounded by great restaurants, unfortunately. I think there's no. Great opportunity for budding restaurateurs out there to come to Acton.
Because, yes, a short hop to Chiswick, but that's about your lot. So where would you like to... Where do you like to frequent?
Well, I used to live in Shepherd's Bush, and there's an amazing Thai restaurant on the Shepherd's Bush Road called Isan Q, which is actually still neighbourhood from Acton because it's just down the road from me. But it's you know, proper old family-run Thai restaurant and delicious.
Andy, what about a fine diner, special occasion?
It's got to be the River Cafe in Hammersmith. Every time I kind of save up and go, it's worth every penny. And I think when it comes to food, I don't really watch the pennies. It's the one thing in my life that I'm very happy to kind of spend, you know, what it requires to kind of, you know, to be where you want to be on that particular occasion. And on a summer's day, you know, being there in the window or out on the terrace, and you know, the quality of their ingredients and the knowledge of the staff, is just kind of, you know, that's my absolute favourite.
The curfew doesn't bother you in the evenings. That was always the thing of being sort of, you know, there to sort of wrap it up by a certain time because of the residents.
I think
go for lunch. then you can stay all afternoon.
Yeah, I think it's probably the way to go.
And living on a boat on the river, if I'm really lucky and the tides are right, I can get a mate to kind of drop me off.
Yeah.
And I just climb up the ladder and over the wall.
Wow, there's a way to live. That sounds great. What about you, Sam, for a fine diner?
Well, I think fine diner is not a word I'd like to put to restaurants where I'd like to go, but I suppose special occasions, we say. I love St John in St John Street in Clerkenwell. It's run by our great friends Fergus Henderson and Trevor Gulliver, and they obviously famous for doing offal and weird bits and pieces, but actually the restaurant's got much more to it than that. Mm-hmm. They're great champions of brilliant British ingredients, great champions of simple cooking, but on at a very high level. And it's, you know, set in an old bakehouse. And it's got an incredible atmosphere. They break their own bread there, so there's always a wonderful, wonderful smell of sourdough bread and this delicious take on English cooking.
You're making me hungry.
And me too.
Eddie, let me just ask you about, you know, a signature dish or a favourite dish. What's the one you always, you know, find yourself going to, you know, oh, I'll have the thing again.
It was a dish that Mum cooked and still cooks, and I suppose you could say it's a Mayokine classic, and whether it be milk-fed lamb or lamb, kind of roasted, with delicious kind of garlic and rosemary, and served with a vegetable accompaniment, which is called tumbet, and tumbet is. It's a real labour of love, because to do it properly, you need to kind of shallow fry all the ingredients separately. So that's aubergine, red pepper and potato. And that's kind of put into a kind of cake, if you like. So it's layered and then kind of with a kind of drizzle of tomato, kind of homemade tomato sauce on the top. And the combination of that with the lamb is absolutely fantastic.
Wow. I really like that. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I'm going to make that. Sam, what about for you? What dish would you choose over and over again?
Well, I think it's always difficult with dishes because it depends what time of year it is. We're sort of obsessed by seasonality. So what you want to eat in a hot August afternoon is not the same as you want to eat on a chilly December afternoon. But given that we're sort of Christmas time, I love eating game. I suppose as a real treat, a roast woodcock is a particularly fine thing. I suppose that the rarity of it, because they're very difficult to get your hands on, which means that when you do, there's a sort of extra relishment. But they've got a very incredibly delicious, rich, characterful flavour, and yeah, well worth seeking out if you can get your hands on one.
Well, we've got hungry. Let's taste some wines.
My Taste with Bibendum Wine.
Right, let's get a wine choice from you, Sam Hart, first of all.
I chose La Gitana Manzanilla from Bodegas Hidalgo. Bone dry sherry from the south of Spain, made by the Hidalgo family. So Javier Hidalgo, who runs the company now, is a good friend of ours. We've been down to see his winery lots of times, and it's a great drink.
Some would be raised eyebrows at a sherry, and yet, you know, it's you're making it trendy again.
Well, we've been singing the praises of sherry for many years, but it's an amazing drink. It's incredibly versatile. It's one of the world's great aperitifs, but it's also delicious with, you know, seafood, with fried food, with ham on, with almonds. And it's the sort of wine that you don't get bored of, because when you're saying desert island wine, I suppose it's, I was trying to think of something you'd be happy to
drink forever.
To drink forever, exactly. Yes. And what's amazing about Manzanilla is that it's clean and crisp and simple, and I do drink it most days.
We got a different Manzanilla here, supplied from Bibendum Wines, and this is from Rodriguez the Barbiana. Beautiful colour. I'm just looking at this, and we've chilled it slightly as well. So is this looking good to you?
Yes, exactly. It's got that sort of slightly strawy colour, chilled. Very important with Fino or Manzanilla sherries. You know, you want it really nice and cold, and refreshing. So on the nose, you get that. Manzanillas come from a town called San Lucas de Barrameda in the south of Spain, and they're aged in big oak barrels. In open-sided warehouses, and the Atlantic breeze comes into the warehouse, and they always say with Manzanilla you can slightly have that smell of the sea to it, and I think you know, you've got that slight salinity on the nose,
yes,
which is incredibly appealing.
But you don't really even need to drink this to experience this, do you? It's all
no.
So much
although, and I haven't had a sip yet. My guess is when you do, you'll get that. First sort of taste of sherry, and then it will develop in the mouth, and you'll get a sort of secondary hit of flavours coming through after you've swallowed it.
Eddie, do you share your brother's passion for this kind of wine?
I do, and I love that part of the world. I think with Manzanilla, which is the very lightest style of sherry, so in the sherry spectrum, from the lightest, freshest style Manzanilla that we're drinking now, you know, right through to something that's dark and sticky and sweet. Pedro Jimenez at the other end. You know, there's such a variety of different styles. But as Sam said, you know, a great aperitif. And there's very little residual sugar in Manzanilla. So, which is, number one, I like that because it's got a very savoury style. And number two, you know, kind of good for people who are watching their weight.
Definitely, yes. And I think this is the first time I've tasted this. And the top of my list would be that dryness in the fact that there isn't any sweetness in it at all.
There's
so
no
I can imagine
sugar,
just starting.
No sugar or fruit at all, so yeah. It's absolutely bone dry.
So for instance, you'd had that, you know, you were talking about that baguette that you'd had before.
Yeah.
The big tasting for the head chef. Maybe a little of this, completely clear the palate.
It's a fantastic palate cleanser. And also, weirdly, if sherry, because it doesn't have any residual sugar or fruit, goes often very, very well with things that are famous for being wine killers, tomatoes, artichokes, things like that, which sort of clash with the fruitiness of normal white wine or indeed red wine. And sherry, because it doesn't have any of that sweetness, pairs brilliantly with a lot of those things that you often struggle with.
Right, let's move on to Eddie's choice. Eddie, now talking about having a desert island wine, you've really pushed the boat out, really, in the fact that you chose this a beautiful Burgundy, didn't you? Well, a nice expensive wine, which sadly we don't have here. We do have an alternative, but what did you choose?
I chose a Gevrey Chambertin from a producer called Dujac, and it was a wine Sam and I really have never bought ourselves, smart wine or expensive wine. But about 5 or 6 years ago, Sam went to a new vintage Burgundy tasting and bought a couple of cases. And I'd completely forgotten, I think Sam had forgotten actually, that we had these cases.
Yeah.
And they were kind of, just doing their thing down in the cellar. and we kind of uncovered them recently, and I just so enjoyed, you know, kind of these bottles. So I'd pull one out on special occasions.
Yes.
And
a week later, they're all gone.
Not quite a week, actually.
I noticed there isn't one here either that you've prepared earlier. Or,
but you know, it's a Pinot Noir, it's a Burgundy. It happens to have a bit of age on it. So that particular wine that I mentioned for my, you know, is just a real treat, and it's got all those secondary flavours, you know, that are kind of, you know, old Burgundies have. But we've got something equally delicious to drink here.
So, well, certainly something which will give us an experience is much younger. It's 2013, this, isn't it? It's a Morgon Gamay grape. What do you make of it, both of you, actually?
I love these styles of wine. You know, I think, you know, kind of, you know, light wine, you know, there's plenty of kind of opportunity where you might want, you know, a lighter style wine, you know, at lunch if you're going to have a glass of something, or in the summer, slightly chilled, is really delicious. You know, where heavier wines kind of wouldn't work so well being chilled down. I think, you know, these styles of wine, you know, work really well.
Sam was saying about lack of fruitiness. I mean, this is just a nose full of fruit, isn't it?
It's got that lovely bright fruit, which I think is the point, isn't it? That sort of, you know, cherries, or, you know, it's very vibrant fruit.
Yes.
You know, rather than sometimes with wine you get that sort of secondary fruit, stewed fruits or overly ripe fruits. So this is sort of lovely, bright, sort of even slightly underripe cherries or something like that.
Indeed, yeah.
I think some people are slightly put off, you know, often with Morgans, you know, they're slightly more expensive than you might think you would have to kind of shell out for a light style wine. But, you know, I think, you know, they are worth the money.
But beautifully elegant.
Yeah.
And you know, joyously, with these days where wine gets ever stronger in alcohol, it's only 12%. So, you know, it's a great lunchtime wine.
A business
day.
Lunchtime sort of thing,
a couple
or
of
whatever.
Bottles and you wouldn't even notice.
And you can go straight back to the desk. Thank you so much for joining us on Taste. It's been really great to meet you. I'm just thinking, you've got this wonderful stable of restaurants. As a final question to you both, do you have your eyes set on maybe a space up one of the new skyscrapers in the City of London, or south of the river, or somewhere else for another restaurant from the Hart brothers?
I think for the moment, we're so lucky that we've got a brilliant team, you know, or brilliant teams in each of the restaurant. And I think, you know, we feel very proud of the latest addition in Barrafina Adelaide Street, and very proud of the team there. So I think just kind of focus, you know, and kind of regroup, and, you know, who knows what in the future. But I think, you know, that what really matters to Sam and I is that we're proud of, you know, each of the restaurants, and, you know, and I think, you know, that over world domination, probably.
Eddie, Sam Hart, thank you very much for coming to see us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
My Taste with Bibendum Wine. Find out more about the flavours you like and discover something new by downloading Bibendum's free app. Search Plonk in your app store.